Take a note or two for yourself. If you need a pencil just or a pen, let us know about that, and we do have them. Used to have, Bill, but I didn't know how to use it either, so that's the way it goes. We do really appreciate having you here with us tonight, and we hope that our time together, besides helping us think about what the Lord has revealed to us, encourages us, makes us be reminded that we have friends and brothers and sisters in the Lord, and that we have people on our side in that way. So we really are grateful to the good Lord for that. Last week, we began our new series for this. I'm going to call it spring quarter. Is that all right for you guys? Does that make you feel nicer if I say spring quarter? We're in our spring quarter? Or does that just make you think we're going to do a two-quarter series here? I told you that I have wanted for a good long while for us to do a class series that I just titled A View of Redemption. And I told you last time that I want for us to do it historically, and then conceptually, and then actually, and we tried to make the point last week that redemption is another word for the divine system of religion. It stands for everything God needed to do and decided to do to purchase back people who are made in His image and His creation from hostile dominion, where it had been taken over by evil, and then to bring it under His wise and gracious rule. And that everything past, present, and future that has to do with those blessings or the benefit of those blessings is what we call redemption. Redemption is another term in partnership with justification, with salvation, with reconciliation, to stand for what we needed and what God did for us. Now, this is sort of, last week we spent some time looking at the meaning of the word redemption and how it comes onto the stage at a time when those things that God made good are now taken over by alienation and frustration and pain and inhumanity and death. That's by the time we get to Genesis 6 in the Bible, every imagination of the thoughts of man's heart is only evil continually. Now here's the question. How does God begin in having a relationship with creatures in that situation? Where does God start? I mean, if you have a hoe, you have a handle where you can get a hold of it and start using it. If you have a car, you'd grab a hold of the steering wheel and begin to make use of that machine. If you have a computer, you have a keyboard or an on and off button or whatever. But if you're dealing with lostness, if something has been taken over by darkness and needs to be purchased back, where do you start? What's the beginning place for that? And that brings us to this important term that we're going to explore tonight. And we're exploring something again, which is a great, great Bible theme. And obviously we'll touch the hem of the garment if I do my best at it. That's still all we would be able to do. But we do need to have this in mind if we're going to talk about redemption. And I'd like to try to show tonight why we say it. What is a covenant? How would you define somebody who's never heard the word? In Old Testament times, this would have been a term familiar to people. But, okay, Ruth, what did you say? All right, a promise. All right, anybody else? How would you explain a covenant to someone to whom this word would be strange? Somebody said a contract? Okay. Anybody else? Agreement? I read somewhere, I think in something that a popular writer right now, Timothy Keller, wrote, that in trying to communicate the meaning of this term to the world right now, we'd need to say, here is something that is way more loving than just a legal contract, but way more binding and more permanent than just affection. It is a rare combination of law and love, which obligates the recipient of it to loyalty to the one who made the covenant, and to gratitude for the benefits of it, and to faithfulness in that way. So we could say it this way, and you guys have all touched on some of these. A covenant is a relationship based on promises or sworn oaths. I'll tell you where I got this statement. This is from Everett Ferguson. This is from Brother Ferguson's definition. I think it's accurate. It is, notice that this is something which is the relationship resulting from a promise initiated by the one establishing the covenant. At this point in the definition, obligation is not in the picture yet. The obligation comes from the covenant, or results from it, but it's a relationship based on promises. Can you think of any human relationships that are like that? With us, it's among equals, of course, but with God, it goes farther than that, but it starts with this. Gloria? Marriage would be the obvious one, especially with Lynn sitting right there by you, right? You had a clue, Gloria. The idea of marriage is I'm going to promise to stand by you even though neither of us know what life is going to bring to us. I'm going to promise to seek your best interest even though right now there's no way of predicting what that will cost me or what it will require of me. That's love, isn't it? So there are other examples. That's the most obvious here. A covenant is what God uses to establish relationship with people. And this is the point of our study tonight. Here is the way a holy God establishes contact and relationship with people who live in a world which has been infected by evil. This is the starting place. This means God chooses to do it. God initiates it. Nobody has earned it from him or caused him to do it. It's something that he decides to do. He takes the positive step. He reaches out. He makes the promise. Only with God, he's the far greater. And with God, he knows what it's going to require of him. He knows what it's going to... Where will it end up? What will it end up costing him? His son. That's right. Will he withhold his own son in order to evade what this promise might require him of him? No, he won't even withhold his own son. And that's a remarkable thing about this. A covenant is the unifying theme of the whole project of redemption. If it's true that Redemption is the divine system of religion. It's also true that biblical religion is covenant religion, meaning it is a result of something God promised to do and did, and it consists then of obligation to Him of gratitude and loyalty because of what He did. And we'll explore that more as we go along. All right, any comment or observation down to here anybody wants to make? All right, let me quickly introduce us then to some of God's covenants that begin the drama of we've already seen the evil. Now, beginning in Genesis 6, we start coming across covenants that God makes where He places Himself in the picture of what's going on in this world, though things have gone wrong, and He starts making promises. Sometimes the promises have no requirement of man. Sometimes they do have requirement of man, but the nature of these promises, nature of these covenants, then end up bringing us to the gift of God's own Son and the covenant in Him. Now, here's what we're going to do. I've given you an outline with the scripture passages on it, and you can explore the actual passages on your own time. I hope you will. I'm going to refer to them without reading the whole passage, all right? So you kind of know. Here are the covenants as we come to them, or some of the ones that we come to that will impact redemption. First one, remember, these are the days when every imagination of man's thoughts, the thoughts of his hearts, are evil all the time. And in this situation, Noah finds favor in the eyes of the Lord. Genesis 6 and verse 8. What is favor? Grace. That's right. Noah finds grace in the eyes of the Lord. We're told as this goes along that Noah was a righteous man. And yet we know from the story afterward that Noah was not a perfect man. Remember? Remember what happens with Shem, Ham, and Japheth and why that happened afterward? So in this case, the earth is corrupt. God sees it. He determines in verse 13 that He's going to make an end of all flesh. However, He still wants to redeem man. You and I know now. He still wants to redeem His creation. So how does he do it? He chooses a man, in this case Noah. And He says in verse 18, I'm going to establish My covenant with you, and you shall come into the ark. He tells him, you and your sons and their wives and your wife and two of every living thing and all of that. Noah does all of this. Notice the covenant is made with him before he does it. He acts in building the ark in response to the covenant God offers to make with him. Then of course, comes the flood, and all living things are, besides what are on the ark, are dealt with. And I suggested last week the importance of looking at for meaning in these passages. And in this case, in Genesis 9:9 and following, after all of this, God establishes a covenant with Noah. What in this covenant? What is the promise? All right, He's never going to destroy the life on earth by the waters of flood again. Never by waters again. That's the covenant. It's just what God says He's not going to do from here on, whatever people do. God is not going to destroy it this way again. What sign of the covenant does He give in this case? The rainbow. And it specifically says it's a sign of the covenant, Genesis 9 and verse 13. And it seems to me that in this passage, God expects something of Noah and of all of us, and it is in Genesis 9 and verse 6 that life be respected. Whoever sheds blood, the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image, Genesis 9 and verse 6 says. So here is one. Now, whatever covenant God makes after this doesn't set this one aside. He still honors this covenant. That's the way things go here. So the next covenant we run across of significance and redemption is with Abraham. Only at this time he's called Abram still. Genesis 12. God tells him to get up. I mean, he's in Ur of the Chaldees. Get up and leave all of that. Leave your father's house. Go to the land I'll show you. And he says, I'm going to make of you a great nation. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make your name great so that you'll be a blessing. And I'm going to bless those who bless you. And I'm going to those who dishonor you, I'll curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. That last phrase is extremely significant to the rest of the Bible. How will God bless all the families of the earth through one man? Okay? And I want to let you know with the history part of it, historically looking at redemption, what we're going to do is come back to this text. And I want to try to explore with you how each of these promises get worked out through the rest of Scripture. Great nation, the land that's here, the blessing of Abram, and then a blessing to all the families of the earth through him. In this case now, this promised descendant becomes important. This son, how's God going to make a great nation out of a man who has no children and he gets old? Does it turn out to be because Abraham is a perfect man? Remember, he started trying to, he listened to Sarah about another way to do this. And then at times he wasn't exactly Sarah's hero. I mean, you go to Egypt and you get to saying, tell everybody you're my sister. You know, that there are things there that make him very human. And yet his faith was great. Noah was a righteous man. Abraham was a man of faith. And what turns out to be the sign of this covenant? Genesis 17. It's circumcision, the circumcision of all of the males. In Genesis 17, that turns out to be the sign of this of the physical covenant with Abraham. I mention a little bit out of order, this time because it's with an individual. He eventually makes a covenant with David. With 2 Samuel 7. Is where this takes place, verses 11 through 16, and then it gets mentioned and praised in several other Old Testament texts. It is that God would not, that God would preserve the throne of the kingdom for a descendant of Abraham, of David to rule from, and that he would establish his kingdom forever. Okay, that's again extremely important. Now this also does not set aside the covenant made with Abraham. So now we have a descendant of Abraham through whom all the families of the earth will be blessed, and a descendant of Abraham who's also a descendant of David who will rule on the throne of the kingdom forever. How can that turn out to be the same person? How's the New Testament start? Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. All right, so there's that idea. And then the one we'll spend a little more time with, there's his covenant now with the people. Remember the descendants of Abraham through Isaac and Jacob end up living where? for 400 years. Egypt, all right, until the iniquity of the Amorites is complete. And then God redeems them from captivity in Egypt, and he brings them to Mount Sinai, having saved them and brought them through the sea and all of that, and he enters into a covenant with them. What was the covenant with Israel? I'll be your God. You'll be my people. You'll be my treasured possession. You'll be a kingdom of priests. You'll be precious to me. And in this case, you notice they as a people agree to the covenant offer before they know what the requirements are going to be, what the conditions are be. So if you read Exodus 19, you see the covenant being offered, and they say, whatever the Lord has spoken, we'll do, and he hadn't even spoken yet. So you get to chapter 20, and now we have the conditions of the covenant. I thought about this one. It doesn't say, here's the sign of the covenant, but you know what in reading from Exodus through Deuteronomy, what I, at least my opinion, that there's a sign of this covenant? It's the Sabbath keeping, in my opinion. Because it meant, you read Deuteronomy 5, it meant to Israel that God had given them rest, that he had delivered them from bondage. It's interesting to think about, at least. You can do some studying about it. But anyway, this is the, these are four kinds of covenant that lead up to a juncture which requires something more that we're going to come to in the, before we finish tonight, hopefully, if somebody doesn't spend too much time on this part of it. So it's interesting down to here to point out that with this last one, something is noticeable which we mentioned with the word redemption. Remember I mentioned this was a word of the marketplace, common in everyday life, that these people were familiar with. I think covenant was that way, especially by the time we're reading in Exodus chapters 19 and 20. Covenant was it was something that took place between the nations. Israel was familiar with the way these things went. A powerful king, someone who could conquer, someone who ruled the whole area, would come to some of these smaller nations with less powerful kings and armies and make them vassals. This is called a suzerain treaty, and it means an overlord kind of a treaty. So I'm gonna offer you a deal. But in return for this, I will protect you and you'll be the benefit of my mighty army, but you have to promise that you recognize my authority, that you pay taxes, that you don't form any other alliance, and you don't rebel against me. That kind of thing was common and explains a whole lot of the language of the Old Testament. And I wish we could explore that a little more. Maybe we can as we go along. But here are the different parts of this type of a covenant. And you can notice, I put on your paper some passages where you can notice this. The covenant pattern that existed is used by God to communicate with the nation now in a way that nations dealt with each other at the time. So think of there, a covenant would begin with a preamble, we'll call it, which was the identification of this great king, this superior power. He'd use all of his glorious titles, and he would explain how wonderful and powerful he was and how lucky anyone would be to have him offer them a deal. And a lot of these type things that sound like a guy who's really carried away with himself and really, really proud of himself. Well, that's the pattern here. Secondly, there's the history, the relationship between the one who is offering the covenant relationship and the one who is deciding whether to accept it. And in this part of it, you'd always have the great king who would place an emphasis on his gracious actions toward the ones who were being offered the covenant. In Exodus 20, for example, I can show you what I mean here. In Exodus 19, this is sort of the preamble or the prologue to the covenant here. Exodus 19, verse 4. God to the people. You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. That's what we mean by this here. And then there are the stipulations. What are the stipulations of the conditions and obligations that would be incumbent upon Israel were they to enter into covenant relation with God? What do they turn out to be? All right, the Ten Commandments. You read Exodus 20, it starts, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me or besides me. And on they go through all of these. And then there will be some sort of a provision made for where this covenant is going to be the document, where it will be kept. Often they were stored in temples and such like among those pagan nations. And then provision made for how often this document would have to be read out loud to the people. How often the lesser king would have to read it to make sure that his people recognize the authority of the one making the covenant. There's the passages I put on the paper are interesting ones and instructive. In Joshua 24, a lot of these elements are brought together. Then there's a list of witnesses to the covenant. And usually they're not people. It'll be heaven and earth and the mountains and the hills and the seas and the stars and the moon and the sun. And all of them will be witness to the agreement that's being made between these covenant partners. And it's a way of emphasizing the soberness, the solemnness of it. And then there would be the pronouncement of the attachment of the blessings of keeping this covenant and the curses for having violated it. We have these in the Bible in Deuteronomy 28, for example. And this is simply the way covenants worked. It was saying, you know, I am the one who has the power to act, and my authority has been challenged. I would be in the right if I simply came and judged your nation, your people. But out of graciousness, I offer you life and well-being. If you do these, if you honor these conditions, these are the blessings that will come. If you don't, you will have rebelled against goodness, and you will reap the results of that. You will have offended my love and goodwill. And so if it were nations, it would be that way. And these, the covenant of covenants that we're talking about can be understood. And then some sort of a ratification ceremony. And this even happens in the other ones. Like In Genesis 17, if you read that, where God cuts the covenant with Abraham. Anybody remember what that meant? Right. The animals were cut in half. Right. They're cut in half. They're laid opposite each other. Abraham has to spend the afternoon keeping the buzzards and such off of it. And then when it gets dark, this fiery pot from the Lord passes through in between those pieces of animals as if to say, we have signed our name to this covenant. In Exodus 24, what happens is the sacrifices, the words are written in a book. Sacrifices are offered. Half of the blood is sprinkled on the book and on the people, and the other half is offered. And it's a way of confirming. And then there was a meal where the leaders of Israel sat down and they saw the Lord that day. I don't know what that means, but that's what it says. And it was a solemn time. Now, here we'll wrap this up now as quickly as we can here with these parts of it. What God does in expressing His relation to His people this way drives home some important spiritual principles. Number one, all of this is extended to His people because of His grace. They did not merit it because of any greatness or goodness on their part. God chose a righteous man, a man of faith, and a spiritual man in David with whom He made covenants. None of them were faultless men. He chose men who He could work with and who He could work from in order to bring about or to further His project of redemption. In Deuteronomy 7, I do want to read this one. Deuteronomy 7, this is starting at verse 7. This is to Israel, of course. It was not because you were more in number than any other people that the Lord set His love on you and chose you, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But it is because the Lord loves you and is keeping the oath that He swore to your fathers, that the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Now look at that. It's not because you were powerful or wonderful or numerous or... It's because the Lord loved you and He's keeping His promises. All right, it's because of His grace. Now, you think about this. These He's redeemed them from slavery in Egypt. Have they been redeemed from sin yet? Okay, now you think about this. You're making a covenant with people in order to bring about redemption, but redemption is not finished yet. So what will it take for that covenant to be kept? It'll take sacrifice, right, but it will take the faithfulness of God. I'm back up here. Steadfast love. It'll be because of, and this is the term for covenant love or faithful love or loyal love, covenant loyalty, that kind of term. It'll be because God keeps His covenant, not because people are good or excel at it. So Deuteronomy 7, verse 9, listen to this. Know therefore that the Lord your God is God, the faithful God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love Him and keep His commandments to 1,000 generations. These covenants end up being not just with the persons to whom they were originally extended, but with their descendants. And they end up being covenants with a people, an individual can fall short of the blessings. God still will keep His covenant. An individual can miss out, but God will keep His covenant with His people. And then the other thing, it'll always involve God's heart. And this is really important in understanding the rest of the Old Testament. God, these are not just legal documents with God. They are the expressions of a father for his children, or a husband for his wife, or a king for his nation, or a judge for his law. And when the covenant is broken, when its conditions are ignored, when unfaithfulness is shown, it hurts God like a father. It hurts God like a husband. It hurts God like a king. It hurts Him like a judge who cares about justice. And Deuteronomy's words, He's a jealous God, Deuteronomy 4 and verse 34. And because of that, it'll hurt His heart. Now, this explains some things about the way the Bible unfolds from here on then. It's the covenant stipulations which open up the possibility of transgression and sin for people to understand what those things are. They're not just violation of rules. They are trespasses against covenant. Hang with me for a minute, and I'll go through this part quickly, because we're coming back to them in the next few weeks. It opens up for us some appreciation for the necessary consequence of judgment and punishment. And these are not because God loses His temper. It's because God enforces His covenant. And if you're going to call down curses in order to enforce covenant, and then the people are disloyal to the covenant, what has to happen? To honor the covenant, what has to happen? If God is a covenant-keeping God, what has to happen? There's His goodness, but there's also what from Romans 11? Severity. And He's the same God. He keeps covenant. But that will mean two things. And so that enters in here. And then the emotions that you find in the words and the images of the prophets really result from this covenant. The courtroom scenes like Micah 6 or in Isaiah chapter 1 or passages like that, Jeremiah chapter 2, or the scenes where God is the victim of an unfaithful wife, like in Hosea chapters 1 through 3, or Ezekiel chapter 16, or where He's a brokenhearted father who's tried to draw his children along with bands of love, and they've not returned His kindnesses in Hosea chapter 11. That's all this here. This is the courtroom scenes in Micah 6. Is the most vivid of these here. So what happens now? We get to the place then where time and time and time again the Israel violates God's covenant. So does God just say, well, I tried, I'm now not obligated. Israel was not faithful to the covenant I made with them. All right, what about the covenant with David? And before that, what about the covenant with Abraham? He's still going to preserve, he's going to honor the covenant, he's going to fulfill them. And what happens is, God then turns attention to a new covenant. Jeremiah 31 I've mentioned here, but really important versions of this are in Isaiah 55, in Ezekiel chapters 36 and 37, with a new covenant in which the law is written within the people, and they know God not because they're born physically into a nation, but because they're forgiven. Ezekiel's new heart and new spirit. Isaiah's the sure mercies of David are here. And then we get to Jesus. the night before he's crucified, the initiation of the Lord's Supper. This cup is what? The new covenant in my blood. This is my blood, which is shed for many for forgiveness of sins, right? Remission of sins. So here, and then we get to Hebrews, and there is in Hebrews 9 and 12 an eternal redemption, which is guaranteed by the eternal covenant with the God of peace in Hebrews 13 and verses 20 and 21. That is a quick survey of where we're headed. And this will be the guiding principle that helps. So to a person who just picks up a Bible and reads it, and you get to the genealogies of 1 Chronicles, how many of you in our daily Bible reading read column 3? The whole first 10 chapters of 1 Chronicles with all those names and genealogies and all that. A person who just picks up the Bible out of the coal and starts reading it thinks, I can't make heads or tails out of this. But if you know the plot, if you can see what's happening, it comes alive for you. And this is the principle. Here's the statement. And I finish with this one from Brother Ferguson. This is from his book on the church, the big book he wrote on the church. Entering into the new covenant makes one a child of Abraham, a servant of the king, and a part of the Israel of God. And that is a great blessing. So next time now, we're going to go back the covenant with Abraham and start exploring how God kept his word. How did it work out? And we'll move along historically in that way. Man, you guys are patient. Some of you are even still awake. We appreciate you being here with us tonight.